Welcome to this week's episode of Virginia Outdoor Adventures Podcast. Each week, we bring outdoor adventure stories and recommendations from athletes, conservationists, authors, park guides, community leaders, and local business owners from across the Commonwealth. I'm your host, Jessica Bowser. Today's guest, Brantley Tindall, completed the Trans Am Bike Race, a 4,191-mile ride across the U.S. The ultra endurance cyclist shares stories from his journey across 10 states, including what it was like to complete the race right here in Virginia. Brantley discusses his gear, how to get started in bike packing, and the best bike trails across the Commonwealth. But Brantley is more than an athlete. His advocacy for safe streets has resulted in the development of new trails that will connect neighborhoods, boost local economies, and serve as a safe and accessible mode of transportation. Let's go. Brantley, thank you so much for joining us today.
It is a real pleasure to be here, Jessica.
What do you love about Virginia's outdoors?
Well, I've lived in Virginia for about 13 years, and when I moved here, I wasn't much of an outdoor person, and I felt privileged to be invited to see so much of what Virginia has to offer because of the great outdoor community. Everything from super steep, remote mountain climbs to Chippewa State Park and everything between. So just the wonderful outdoor community here, especially in the Richmond region where I'm from, but I've met a lot of outdoorsy folks from Harrisonburg area as well, who are just super inviting, and I couldn't thank them enough.
You know, my experience traveling throughout the state is that the people you meet are really friendly. And not only are they friendly, but they're really welcoming, especially in some of the small towns where trails pass through. They're used to seeing people coming off the trails and excited that they're there. And so they're usually very accommodating towards folks who are riding either, you know, bikes or horses or just walking or passing through.
Can confirm.
What got you interested in cycling?
You know, well, I moved to Richmond for college, went to VCU and got a degree in environmental studies. And it was in the big kind of zeitgeist after Al Gore's film Inconvenient Truth. And I was very motivated by learning as much as I could about the environment. And really, Richmond and Virginia are a great place to learn about those things. And I immediately crashed my car. Just had like a silly little crash in Oregon Hill, a mile from campus. And I immediately found a need to be able to get around. And I didn't have like the money or really want to deal with going through the process of getting a new car. And I was a little bit embarrassed because I crashed my car. And so I just got a very bare bones old bike from a thrift store. And I ended up doing all kinds of crazy riding on it. Just because I needed a commute and was doing 1 or 2 miles at a time, and then found myself doing 3 or 4 miles at a time. And then I found like a couple of friends to ride with, and I was doing 5 or 10 miles occasionally. And then I found myself accidentally riding to Williamsburg one day, and it's like, wow, I think I can keep doing this. And it's really just been all up since.
I'll bet. I mean, I can't imagine just accidentally finding yourself riding to Williamsburg. That's not usually something that most people do.
you just don't stop. That's all.
Yeah, I guess so. You just keep going. So you have done some pretty long races, including the Trans Am bike race. Do you want to talk to us about what that is and what it involves?
Absolutely. Some people or many of your listeners, I'm sure, are familiar with the cross country route called that was originally launched during the bike centennial, the celebration of America in 1976 that became this call to Americans to ride their bikes from coast to coast. So the Trans America bike route was established at that time, and it was established in advance of that, in order to allow families really to ride their bikes in a very, you know, leisurely at your own pace over the summer kind of approach from either Astoria, Oregon on the West Coast to Yorktown or in the opposite direction. And something like tens of thousands of people did it that summer. And it was trailing this national bike boom that happened in the early 70s. It was like a, it was a big deal that people were able to do that. And with the advent of really GPS and smartphones, a race ended up being able to be made on this route that was self-supported, because an individual racer can just use their phone and other sort of GPS bike computers to be able to navigate it without relying on paper maps or relying on kind of a group to be able to navigate and all the dynamics of a race. That race started, I believe, in 2013 or 2014, the inaugural race, and there's actually a really great film about it called Inspired to Ride, that if you'd like to learn more about this kind of race, I really encourage you to watch, because it's really good, and there's some really interesting characters in that movie that explain the race, but also kind of explain the process and gives a little bit of it casts a spotlight on some of the characters, which I say, in the nicest way, of the people who choose to do this kind of crazy adventure. So the race itself is self-supported, meaning you can't accept aid from anyone. You have to bring everything that you're going to use, or you have to buy it along the way. And it is from Astoria, Oregon to Yorktown, Virginia, through 10 states. I think it's 160,000 feet of climbing, which is 4,200 miles. And you're not allowed to accept any aid along the way. So you have to build a bike and buy all the equipment, and then carry all that equipment that you're going to use to go from, in my case, as low as 23 degrees Fahrenheit in June, which is a little bit crazy, as low as 23 degrees and as high as 105. You got to be able to have clothes that work for that. You've got to be able to have a bike seat that you can sit on 16 hours a day if you're going to be kind of at the pointy end of the race to be able to complete. To be able to complete it in a competitive time, you really have to ride from about 15 to 16 hours a day to get enough miles in. And then you have to have a tracker. So there's a race organizer who works with a company called Track Leaders. That's essentially a GPS satellite location company that has a software platform where you rent or buy a GPS tracker that's on your bike at all times and has to have kind of clear view to the sky. And your position is broadcast 24/7 while it's on. And so every racer in the race has a GPS device that sends their location, and really spectators in the sport, they're called dot watchers, very welcoming term. Dot watchers, the community of people who follow this race on Track Leaders, can see every bike racer in real time on the map of the course, on the map of the United States, which is just an amazing experience. And before this, it's like, that was not possible. Before GPS trackers, before this kind of software, before our phone technology, this kind of sport really couldn't exist. And it's probably a good time to differentiate it from another race that a lot of people are really familiar with, which is the Race Across America, which is the very traditional race format from coast to coast. That's from California to, I think, New York. Maybe it's DC. It's shorter. It's 3,000 miles, and it has a time cutoff. So it's a little bit different. But that is the biggest difference between my race, the Trans Am, and Race Across America is the Race Across America is a supported race, meaning the typical way that people do it, whether it's solo or with the team, is you have a van or an RV or even two vans and two RVs trailing you the entire race. So they are feeding you, they're changing your clothes, you have a soft thing to sleep on when you have to take a break, or you're changing out your teammates. If your bike breaks, you're not fixing it. You've got someone there to fix it. And it's really the only way to complete Race Across America is to do it supported, because the time cutoffs are relentless. You've got to be able to do 250, 300 miles a day just to be able to finish in time. So I think that race started in the 70s, and it's it's a little bit like the Ironman model or other event companies where it's an event company that has made a big production out of it. The Trans Am is a bit of a reaction to it. It's by design kind of rugged. It's very much about the individual racers. There's not a lot of pomp. There's not a big finish line banner or, you know, like a big sound system, like the things that you might expect with a big event. And there's really no course support whatsoever. Like, I had a few text messages with the race organizer over the 3-week race, and that was about it. And so the pursuit of this race is a little bit different. Like, it's more adventure racing. Most people would call it ultra endurance bike racing, or ultra endurance bike packing is another way to call it, because you bring a lot of equipment, and most people choose to sleep on the side of the road or camp as part of the race, which is a bit of the kind of the traditional approach and an homage to the original bike centennial, where families would bike this over the course of 3 months, and they'd sleep and camp along the way and stay in hostels. So I think that's a pretty good sort of description of the race.
So just to review, the entire race is approximately 4,200 miles, right?
Yep.
And you said across 10 states?
Yep.
And it took you 3 weeks to complete?
So I have the odd distinction to have two times to say that I completed. And it's a little strange. I'll get into it a little bit in my sort of my race narrative. But typically, traditionally, the number that I would have to say is 22 days. It's like almost on the nose, 22 days to complete the race. But I have to say that that included one full day of no riding at all. So I like to think in my head that it was 21 days.
I see.
It was because of a blizzard on the border of Montana and Wyoming, right at Yellowstone National Park, that basically shut down that area, and the park was closed for a full day.
Wow. So if there is an episode or a natural disaster or whatever happens, you're just out of luck. You have to wait until you can pass.
The clock keeps ticking. And so some of it, over the course of a 4,200-mile race, there are a lot of decisions to be made. It's not just like you're riding and then you decide to stop, and then you're riding and then you decide to stop. You have to decide, okay, am I going to push through another 2 or 3 hours or 100 miles? If those are not equal, by the way, but you know, like, do I need to dig deep now to go farther so that I can make it past a thunderstorm, or to try to get ahead of this blizzard, or should I rest now and try to, like, so much of it has to do with the weather, so that, like, well, I'm going to have to sleep sometime. Maybe I sleep now so they don't get rained on. Or maybe I need to put 3 extra hours in tonight. It's 2 a.m., but I need to keep going because it'd be better if I didn't get totally wet in the middle of the night. So some of the race tactics and the way it plays out, and what makes it so interesting to the dot watchers, is there are people around the world watching it happen in real time, literally just as dots on a map. And then you can, you know, there's an additional element of if you want to go down the well of following some of these racers on social media, you might be able to find some additional things. But, you know, trying to ascertain what's going on in a racer's head, and you can watch, you know, like a weather radar app or something at a little town where someone is, like someone's in Emporia or someone's in Eugene, Oregon, and like there's about a storm about to come through. There are racers who really like put a lot of time and focus into that to see just what play is happening and what act they're in. And it's a really interesting, it's a little bit of an interesting way to view a sport, because it's not all plain and displayed in a heads up display, like when you're watching maybe like a baseball game or football game or baseball or basketball, where they like kind of show you the stats, they show you the team name, they show you all these different things. You kind of have to find it yourself. And the community of dot watchers tends to communicate on a few Facebook groups that are race specific, and they love telling you all the different things that are happening. I heard about this, and you know, someone saw this bike racer come through this town in Kentucky, and they look terrible. And so, like, it's that community themselves almost doesn't care about the race. It's like they just like seeing, or they don't care about who wins, what they really care about is the drama and the like, being able to analyze it on their own.
So they're like sports commentators, but local sports commentators who just comment on what they see coming through town.
Yeah. And a great thing about this race, too, is if you live along the race course, a lot of people come out and see you. So like they'll follow your dot and they're like, OK, they're coming through Emporia, Kansas. We should, you know, we got about 30 minutes. So let's get out there. And they'll bring you like, this is sort of, it's borderline against the rules, but it's, I'll have to explain this a little bit, but, there are things called trail angels where anyone is encouraged to come out along the race course and give some minor things to the bike racers. As long as it doesn't like really affect their race and you're not favoring any one or other riders over any others. So like you are encouraged to come out if you live along the route, let's say in Christiansburg, you can come out and give bike racers like cold water or like a local sandwich or something like that, right? You can't like, you can't significantly help them like give them a ride or you can't give them equipment, but you can, if in good faith, you can come out and like catch all the racers that you can. It'd be impossible to catch them all, but any of them that you can reasonably catch, and you would give them a little pick me up, you're allowed to do that. And so it's a sport that you can literally participate in. And I didn't get a bunch of trail angels that there. If you do that, you're called a trail angel. Which is the similar terminology if you're going to be through hiking the Appalachian Trail or the Pacific Coast Trail or something like that.
Right.
I didn't get a bunch, but when I did, I will remember those moments forever. I got a great family in Missouri. I got some of my personal friends came out and met me near the Blue Ridge Parkway, near Afton Mountain, and like that, I will never forget it. But you tend to find people when they're at their lowest, and like you give them a Pop-Tart, and you just made their day.
Right. And so when you're not passing through towns, I'm sure you're going through a lot of rural areas where you don't see people for a long time.
Oh, yeah. Your only company is gas station attendants for about 2,000 miles.
Wow. So you're alone with your thoughts for about 2,000 miles.
Yeah, that's not so bad, though.
How much of that race goes through Virginia?
Interestingly enough, so it's 4,200 miles and goes through 10 states, which means on average, you've got about 420 miles per state. Virginia has the most miles. I called it the Transamerica bike route earlier, which is true, but most people call it U.S. Bike Route 76, sort of a nod to the 1976 bike centennial. It's like it's signed in Virginia, or at least almost all of it is. So if you want to go out and ride a section of it, it's pretty easy to follow. And Virginia, among the states that I rode through, was probably the best signed, if not the best. One of the great things about U.S. or Virginia as it relates to the U.S. bike route system is that we have the most mileage of any state in the country we have the most U.S. bike route mileage. So we have U.S. Bike Route 76, which is east and west, and then we have U.S. Bike Route 1, which is north and south and goes from Maine to Key West, Florida. And so if you add those two up, we have the most U.S. bike route mileage in the country for any state, and we have the most miles on U.S. Bike Route 76 of any of the 10 states that we ride through, which makes it a little bit of a highlight. And especially when you're going west to east, you're ending in Virginia. You get to end at what seems like the biggest, best part of it.
Yeah. So talk a little bit about that. So you're riding through 9 other states. You finally hit the 10th and last state, which is Virginia. What does it feel like when you finally hit the border and then when you actually start to get close to the very end of the race?
It was pretty amazing, I have to say. At a number of state transitions, but when we crossed from Kentucky into Virginia, the land looked different. The way the roads were built was different. Making it from the hollers of Kentucky the really tight winding roads that were pretty, they're pretty treacherous to ride on. They're steep and winding and dark. You don't know what you're going to approach on the way, you know, around a bend. And you cross the state line into Virginia and it's like, ooh, flowing Blue Ridge Parkway, like just gorgeous and like kind of like low intensity. And just like that kind of magic Appalachian feel that I crave all the time when I want to go out and ride in Roanoke or Harrisonburg or the Crozet area. And I think it had to be partly it's in my head. I'm a Virginian. I've been here for a long time and I'm like starting to see roads that I know, like that familiarity and nostalgia and kind of comfort of not being in a brand new place in a kind of high intensity area or high intensity competitive experience. And it's like, I can kind of let my hair down. I'm back. But also like, gosh, Virginia is a magical place. And I just will tell people that forever.
Let's talk about bike packing for just a moment, because a lot of people participate in bike packing, but are not necessarily racing. It sounds like you were doing both at the same time. What is it like to be bike packing, especially over such a long distance? Like, what do you need to have with you? Where do you sleep? Do you have to plan things out in advance? Like, what kind of planning goes into this?
If you know, I've been using the term bike packing, if you're not super familiar with it, bike packing is simple as riding your bike somewhere, camping, and then riding back. That's oftentimes kind of like a weekender, you might call it. But I actually did a great one when I got back from my race, and my bike team and I did a bike packing trip out to Chip Oaks State Park in Surrey and spent the night in hammocks or camped out and then rode back the next day. And it's really great from Richmond to be able to do that, because about 80 or maybe 90% of that route is on the Virginia Capitol Trail. So it's just it's a paved trail separated from cars. You can ride as slowly as you like. It goes through cornfields and forests, and it's just a very easy, casual thing. And then you get to Jamestown, where you get to take a ferry to across the James. And then you're on some kind of country roads until you get to the park. And it's just a glorious thing. And I recommend anybody do that. It's a really cool thing. So the only thing that I did that was different was that instead of it being 2 days and sleeping on the ground once, it was 3 weeks and I slept on the ground about 10 times, thereabouts. And it's a wild thing. So one of the things about this kind of racing environment is you really, as much as you can plan, and I did a lot of planning. I spent a whole year making Google spreadsheets of what all the gear I was going to use, or where all the stops were, all the different hotels along the route. I found gear lists from other people who've done the race. And so I copied their gear lists. So I made sure that I wasn't missing anything. And like, I kind of cherry picked the things that I wanted. And I convinced myself to that I wouldn't need this or I wouldn't need that. So I would go super ultra light. So I wasn't carrying too much stuff or really carrying too much volume, because what you really run on, the problem that you run into is that you can't carry very much like capacity. It doesn't even matter how much it weighs. It's more like I just can't literally fit anything else in these bags. The kind of the real trick to this race is never be stopped. I'll do everything you can while moving. It's like I brushed my teeth while I was riding. I was on the phone a bunch while I was riding. I was looking at my phone, trying to decide where I was going to sleep that night, where I was going to eat next, what the weather was going to be. I did as much as I possibly could. Like, even if you're going 5 miles an hour, it is better to be always moving forward than it is to stop and try to figure that stuff out, because you'll look up and half an hour had gone by and you get caught by somebody. So all the preparation I did with the gear lists and the lodging and logistical kind of spreadsheet / map that I put together all boiled down to always be moving. Sleep as little as you can. Don't really ride hard. Just never be stopped. You can really burn your legs up trying to average 1 or 2 miles an hour faster than your kind of like average pace, which will make you super tired and make you have to eat a lot more. It can really affect your mood, especially towards the end of it. You start to kind of go through these ebbs and flows of mood where they can get kind of low sometimes, especially at altitude. Don't worry about going hard. Really, it's all about don't ever just be stopped. And so in order to be super efficient, one of the things is you you have to sleep most nights. There were two nights that I didn't really sleep, but you have to sleep most nights. And if you want to save some time, the best way to do it is to sleep on the side of the road. And if you're in rural Idaho, all you really need is the 2 to 4 hours of not moving and having some shut eye, and you can kind of peel yourself off the ground and get back to it, as opposed to having to go through a hotel registration process and get checked in and checked out, and to get yourself out of a warm, comfy bed to go out and ride in the cold rain. It is much more difficult to do that when you're in a hotel than it is when you're in a post office, which I did twice, which is just a kind of a wild experience. Or if you're sleeping, like the other wilder, like kind of very off the beaten path place that I slept was under some road construction equipment in Idaho. Like I was just getting tired and I slept under the bucket of a giant backhoe, just because I needed to keep some wind off of me. And in case it was going to rain, I wanted to keep some of the precipitation off of me. And I needed to be hidden from the road so that nobody would mess with me. I only slept for about 3.5 hours probably. I was trying to make it into a town, and I just was like falling asleep at the wheel. And so I decided, you know, I'm just, the next place I see that has some shelter, I'm going to just peel over and sleep in a bivy sack, which is what I like to describe as a rain jacket. That's it's a rain jacket meets a body-sized trash bag. That's what a bivy is. You just wrap yourself in a plastic cocoon, just comfortable enough that you don't die, but nothing else. It's really no frills, but it saves you an hour to 2 hours, and you know, $50 to $100 every time that you don't have to stay in a hotel. Mm-hmm. It's you're a little more motivated to get off the uncomfortable ground to get riding the next day than you are out of a cushy bed, which. I got a couple of bad weather stories, and this isn't my worst one, but as I was nearing the end, I approached, you know, I made it from Eastern Kentucky into Western Virginia, Southwest Virginia. You make it to past Brake State Park, and I was fighting my way to get into Damascus. And the only place that I had to stay in Damascus was kind of a ritzy resort kind of hotel. It was like $150 a night, and I'm like super dirty, like haven't shaved. I'm like, horrendously gross bike racer, slept on the ground, you know, that kind of thing. And the night before I had probably slept in a post office or something like that. And I'm racing my butt off after 3 weeks or almost 3 weeks to make it to Damascus before a thunderstorm hits. And let me tell you, if you've never been hit by a thunderstorm at 2:15 in the morning in the middle of rural Southwest Virginia, consider yourself lucky. That was just terrible. And I made it to Damascus. So it hit at exactly 2:00 on the dot. And I just get drenched with like crazy thunder and like super wet. And I'm 15 minutes outside of Damascus. If I'd have been 15 minutes faster, if I'd have just gone through those store stops just a little bit quicker throughout that day, I could have made it and not gotten wet. But instead, I get to this nice hotel in Damascus and I'm dripping wet and just burning mad because I'm just like I'm like cracking a little bit, right? Like my mood just can't handle it, and I get into this incredibly nice ritzy hotel that's designed for like weekend getaways for people on their anniversary, and there's like nice little lotion bottles and there's like just all the little things that you see in a hotel, and I just jump in bed wet, dirty, horrendously like smelly and everything, gritty. And I don't even take my clothes off or anything. I just get in bed. And I did not want to get out of bed the next morning. I was in such a bad mood to have to peel myself out of there. So there's a bunch of efficiencies if you can not let yourself get too comfortable.
I can imagine that would be difficult, especially after being on the road for so long. But you were so close to the end at that point, and the end is in Yorktown, you said. So what was it like actually reaching the finish line?
I would say that the feeling of, I'm finally done, you know, like this great physical accomplishment. I'm so happy to have done it. That was so superseded by the fact that a bunch of my coworkers and friends came out to see me. I work for Sportsbackers in Richmond, which is a nonprofit sports commission, and we do a bunch of nonprofit advocacy for things like bike lanes and paved trails, and we run school running programs, and we train local sort of volunteers to be fitness instructors, to bring fitness classes into communities that don't have access to gyms or other kinds of fitness opportunities. So we really try to get fitness into every corner of the community. And I had 15 or 20 of my coworkers came out to see me, and my mom was there, which is a really big thing for me, because one of the reasons why I did this race is to draw attention to the need for more biking and pedestrian safety, which is what I do at Sportsbackers. I'm an advocate for that kind of thing. My mom was hit by a drunk driver when I was in high school, and it was a rough, traumatic thing at the time. And you know, she was injured, but it seemed like she was going to heal. But really, what ended up happening is her health cascaded for and continues to cascade down since then, 20 years later. And she's in a powered wheelchair, and she has a lot of mobility challenges and health issues, and is really just kind of the dominant force in her life. And it just would have been great if she hadn't been hit by a drunk driver. And so that's what motivates me to think about rethinking how our streets look and who we're building them for. And her story and being able to talk to her on the phone every day was, and like actually multiple times a day, like maybe I probably bothered her a little bit too much. Was really one of the major motivating factors for why I wanted to do this. I'm not really one to do things for attention. I think that's a perfectly legitimate reason to do this kind of a thing. If you just want to show off how good you are, that's amazing. But I wanted to do it because I wanted to do something ambitious and audacious just so people would ask me why. Just so I could say it should be safer for people. And so being able to share that sort of victory with my mom was really among the most amazing things, and to have like my friends and my coworkers there. So the guy that I finished with, he ended up finishing, I think, about sixth. The guy that I finished with, Matthew from Australia, we finished, I think we tied for 11th.
So you came in 11th place, tied with somebody else.
That's what it says on the website. So
So you mentioned that you work for Bike Walk RVA and you are the director of outreach. Can you explain your current role?
Sure. I alluded to some of the work that we do at Sportsbackers, and Bike Walk RVA is our bike and pedestrian infrastructure program. So we lead and train advocates to get policies that build safe places to bike and walk. That's our mission. Under the umbrella mission of Sportsbackers, to make the Richmond region the most active region in the country. And the story, as I've learned it since I started working here, and we're approaching 30 years as an organization, and I've been there for about seven. When the organization was formed, we ranked fairly low as far as communities go on their activity levels. And there's a national organization that ranks these communities based on things like event participants and park acreage and all the different ways that you can measure how active a community is. We were ranked pretty low for starting paying attention to this. And around the time that I joined the organization, we had climbed from something like 250th to 18th or 19th, which was very inspiring to me when I joined Sportsbackers. And I joined right after they had formed Bike Walk RVA as part of a strategic plan to bring in more programmatic work. So our bread and butter for getting people more active is we run the Richmond Marathon and the Monument Avenue 10K, which are some of the biggest running races in the country. And we use the revenue that we generate from those major sporting events, which are themselves very marquee events for people in Richmond to find themselves encouraged to run. The Monument Avenue 10K is probably the biggest sort of couch to running event that exists, at least in the country. It's a great motivator. And we as an organization, we intentionally made the decision that we were going to use the Monument Avenue 10K to build activity in the Richmond region. Like, it was an event really for Richmonders, not to exclude anyone else, but it was about getting Richmonders more active. So we made it super Richmond feel. It's a celebration of a really great street to run on. And we have had a lot of success doing that. So as those events supported it, we have grown kind of the pie about what Sportsbackers does in order to build bike and pedestrian infrastructure, because we realized that event registrations as a kind of a metric in that ranking system aren't enough to get to everyone. Like if we want the most active community in the world, or in the country, you can't do that just by how many people run your marathon. That's a really great indicator, but how many bike lanes do you have? What's your sidewalk network look like? How many bike trails do you have? Do you have bike share? Do you have great placemaking, like a riverfront plan? And so we took a much more intentional and intense effort to get more bike lanes built, get more trails built, build some bike and pedestrian bridges, work at the General Assembly, our state legislature, to get policies that fund these things, and to really bring our Richmond region together so that we have bike lanes and trails that cross through different localities. It's a lot of work. And one of the main ways that we get it done is we've built authenticity into the way that we advocate for things, where it's not just Brantley Tindall and my boss, Louise Lockett Gordon, going to meetings. And it's just the two of us and this, you know, the same old two bike people that go to every meeting. That's a recipe for failure on the long run. So what we, as the primary way that we get this stuff, these policies made, is we empower and encourage people to be very effective advocates on their own. So we teach what we call the Bike Walk RVA Academy, and we've now graduated about, I think, 7 classes of the Bike Walk RVA Academy, which they average about 20 people per academy. So 130, 140 people have graduated from this program. And it's a 5 to 8 week evening academy or training session where you learn how to plan a campaign. How do you talk to your elected official? What does good bike infrastructure look like? How is it funded? How is it built? We bring in speakers like city council people and supervisors and state electeds and the staff from departments of transportation or departments of public works who build these things, so that we can kind of build bridges for people to establish relationships and to empower them with the right terminology and to know when they're building the right thing or not, that sort of thing. And we're one of a number of partners around the state who intentionally spotlight and add energy to our alternative and active transportation framework, so that we're building bike lanes, we're building sidewalks, we're building bike trails. And my personal favorite of all of these different infrastructure types is our bike and pedestrian only bridge that crosses the James River, which is really the heart of our city. The T. Tyler Potterfield Memorial Bridge, it's biking and walking only, is really close to the water. And if you may know that the James River is a really kind of wild and adventurous river, and this bridge is built pretty low to the water. And so sometimes when the water is high, it's like you're on the water. It's like you can hear the rushing water and the wind, and it feels like it's got a bunch of energy. And if you're listening to this and you haven't been to it,
I think bridge is actually really great. Almost every time that I stay in downtown Richmond, I find myself walking across that bridge. It's a great view of the city once you get to the other side of the bridge. And there are so many people passing you on that trail. Like, it's a really well-used trail. So I think the residents of Richmond really enjoy that trail and like utilizing it. And there are also examples of other really great trails all around the state that have come from the same type of advocacy that you were just mentioning. And I can think of like the WNOD trail up in Northern Virginia that connects quite a few towns throughout Northern Virginia. The High Bridge Trail seems like a great example that passes through Farmville, and also the New River Trail. I think the New River Trail, the New River Trail and High Bridge Trail are rail to trails, where they converted old railways railroads into trails.
It's so great riding to Farmville too, like the cute little town. Absolutely. Get a cup of coffee and hang out in the train.
Yeah, loose, absolutely.
Right? The WNOD is maybe 44, mm-hmm. and then the The Virginia Capitol Trail is 52, and that one is maybe the most recently completed of the big trails. And it is from Richmond east to the to Jamestown.
So you did mention riding the Virginia Capitol Trail to Chipokes Plantation State Park. So that trail, I believe, did you say it runs along an already established highway? How was that trail developed?
That's a great question, and I'll say that could be the subject of its own podcast, and I would not be the star of that particular one. But the idea started around the year 2000, maybe just a hair before that, in the late 90s, and ground broke in 2005, and it was completed in 2015. The very last part of the trail was accelerated by Richmond being the host of the World Championships, the Road Cycling World Championships, which was a really great time to be in Richmond if you like bikes. And so that probably shortened the overall completion by about a year, maybe 2 years. And so it took about 10 years to build that 52-mile trail. Part of what made that trail, made that possible, particularly in our region where we didn't have something quite like that, and VDOT and other partners were kind of new to that kind of trail building. One of the things that made that a great trail for the first one that you're going to do in a region is that a bunch of that land that was used to build the trail was in VDOT right-of-way along Virginia 5, or John Tyler Highway, that connects Richmond to Jamestown and Williamsburg. So it didn't require a bunch of land acquisition and a bunch of property owners. It did require some. No 50-mile trail is going to be a walk in the park, but it had many advantages from that.
Mm-hmm. And are there any new trails that we can expect to see being developed in the near future?
I would certainly hope so. And I'll talk about a couple of quick ones before I talk about the big one that I really want to talk about. Among the roles that I have as a bike advocate, I serve on the board of directors for Virginia Bicycling Federation, which is this sort of statewide bike advocacy group. And they spend their biggest role is legislation at the General Assembly. And they've been, to their credit, they were able to get a number of laws passed over the years, including 3-foot passing and being able to cross a double yellow line in order to safely give 3 feet to a bike rider without passing in the lane, that sort of thing. That's one of the main things that they do, but they're also supporting a couple of trail development projects that are more along the rails to trails mindset, which is the Eastern Shore Trail in Northampton. And I just learned about a new one today that is the Shenandoah Valley Trail. So these are some trail concepts that are, I think, in early stages, but have a good shot of being turned into trails a lot like the High Bridge or the Virginia Creeper and other trails mm-hmm. like that in the state. The next project that I have a bigger role supporting and building and crafting the idea for is the Ashland to Petersburg Trail, which is pretty easy to understand as a trail from Ashland to Petersburg that would be more of a more akin to your Virginia Capitol Trail or the WNOD, in that it would be a paved trail wide, and what you might think of as kind of a high polished kind of trail, meant very much for transportation as much as for recreation. And the thing that would differentiate it from the its closest trail, which is the Virginia Capitol Trail, is that it would be a little or significantly more the alignment of the trail will be significantly more steered towards connecting communities like Ashland, the city of Richmond, the city of Colonial Heights, and Petersburg through Chesterfield County, Henrico County, and Hanover County. So 7 localities, and going right through and into some of the most developed parts of those communities, as opposed to kind of taking the rural scenic byway kind of approach. Now, it's going to have, if built, it would have plenty of scenic byway sections, but it would it would be very intentionally connect local Main Street business corridors. It would very intentionally connect the downtown riverfront in Richmond and the downtown riverfront in Chesterfield / Colonial Heights / Petersburg, right at the Appomattox. It would also cross the Chickahominy, and it would go right down to the heart of what has become a very bike-centric place in Ashland. And really, it would focus as much on the destinations and the communities that it could connect to things like local businesses and employers and tourism, as it would be about the excellent riding that it could have as well.
Mm-hmm. What I understand from talking to people across the state is that oftentimes when a trail is built, then the towns around that trail start to develop and start to boom, and the economy improves around the trail. So it's not that those places are already there and established. They might be small towns, but as the trail gets built, then they start to see more people coming in. And as people are utilizing the trail, they're looking for places to eat and places to spend the night, and they're interested in things to do. And so more and more people start to come to these towns that weren't visiting before, and the next thing you know, you've got a town that is booming around the trail.
Absolutely. And you know, we talked about Damascus, and I think that's one of those towns that really has taken a trail and highlighted it as a feature and really grown because of it. I don't know if we'd get quite that same level for this kind of trail, because the communities that are along this alignment are fairly well established. But there is certainly room for development and growth, and that's one of the things that our state and regional leaders see as a benefit for building this sort of trail. To kind of give you a little bit of background about how this trail concept came around, you know, locally we've got the Virginia Capitol Trail, and I've ridden on the Virginia Creeper and the oh my gosh, what's the one that goes to Galax?
The New River Trail.
Mm-hmm. Is that the New River Trail? And then High Bridge Trail, the WNOD, and the other trail networks in Northern Virginia. There's mm-hmm. the Mount Vernon Trail and the Custis Trail. And I've ridden from D.C. to Pittsburgh on the Great Allegheny Passage and the CNO Canal. And those are all really exemplary trails. But some of the ones, we went farther afield for some inspiration on when crafting the Ashland to Petersburg Trail concept. And one of the places that we went that was most beneficial was Indianapolis. And you don't really think about Indianapolis as this like trail haven, but they've got this wonderful trail called the Cultural Trail, or the Indianapolis Cultural Trail. And that was built specifically to connect cultural districts, which in Richmond, you might think about like connecting neighborhoods that have a lot of multifaceted uses. So like Scott's Addition to Monroe Ward to Manchester. You've got residential, you've got arts and entertainment, you've got maybe university type stuff, you've got breweries, and then you have a lot, and you know, lots of opportunity for new and ancillary emergent land uses and density. They were really struggling in the mid-2000s. They were, you know, a lot of activity in residential and arts communities were leaving Indianapolis, and city planners and philanthropists were struggling to figure out how to fix it. And they wanted development, and they wanted to be able, they needed, you know, civic activity and tax base and things to be able to solve city problems like all cities have. And the city and their major philanthropic organizations in Indianapolis chose to focus on connecting communities with a trail that is built, as I sort of was describing before, at the heart of the urban density where people want to be. Like, if you build the trail at origins and at destinations and you connect them and you don't put them on the periphery and you don't kind of shove them in gullies and weird alleys and that sort of thing, you make it front and center and you make it beautiful with landscaping and great design. You make it wide enough to plan for success that you have a bunch of people biking and walking on it so that you're future compatible, you know, you're prepared for it to be popular and crowded at times, and you have to build it with that in mind. And what they saw is that restaurant destinations started to flourish and arts communities started to flourish, and people started moving back into Indianapolis. And then a couple of years later, they started attracting major employers like Salesforce and other major corporate employers, and local businesses were thriving. And it became a place where people really wanted to go. And, you know, you could, like, if even if you weren't in downtown Indianapolis and you drove and you parked, you could get around everywhere you needed to go that night on a bike or walking. And so bike share really started to work, and it became a place for neighbors to meet and be neighborly and to have outdoor civic meetings. And these are all the things that are really on the table for this kind of trail here. And there are a few other trails around the country that have this kind of very dense urban mindset. So it's not that Indianapolis is its own thing, but we think that's the one that's the most highlighted. And we brought one of the leaders of that trail to Richmond to meet a bunch of our local elected officials and state officials and transportation staff to tell the story, to say, like, this could work here too. And, like, what are your questions? How can we make this work? And one of the big questions was, well, what does it cost and what's the benefit? And what I'd love to lead with is that they very casually, like as if it were no stretch, throw around the billion word when we're talking about how much money it can generate from a tax base and economic development standpoint. When you're talking about attracting major employers that bring dozens and hundreds and thousands of employees, when we're talking about taking unused and under-resourced land, like you might see around the Route 1 corridor south of Richmond, it's ripe for development and for new corporate entities and new local businesses. And it's a ripe opportunity for people in Richmond and Petersburg to go get some of the greatest tacos in the region, which are all on all on Route 1 in Chesterfield. Like, it's really win-win for a lot of folks, and it helps solve other problems too. Like, I also serve on the board of RVA Rapid Transit, and I want to see all of these different kinds of active transportation flourish. And biking and walking is such an important integral way to make transit work. And we've been working really hard to get transit to be expanded outside of just the city. And we've had some pretty good successes, but we have a long way to go. And one of the areas that doesn't have transit access, that has a lot of communities that need that that kind of transportation access, live on Route 1 south of the city in Chesterfield and Colonial Heights. This bike trail, biking and walking trail, is the ticket to making transit work in a place where if you put a line there, you can't get to it. So it's a very multifaceted thing where we're talking about building an environment where we can get a lot of new employers and a lot of new housing and a lot of new development and density, and really looking at maximizing what land use can do for all the different things that it can for residential and business and the environment, the way people get around, especially like thinking in a kind of post-pandemic society where working from home is going to be a, you know, it's not going away. We've learned that working from home is actually really a beneficial thing, and I don't think we're going to forget it. These sort of trails help to localize and get people to spend time in their communities differently, where instead of everything being rushing and getting to work and then coming back home, it's like, I just need to take a break from my working from home day, and I'm going to go out for a walk, or I'm going to use my lunch break a little bit differently. You're already seeing that happen. And you're also seeing that in a lot of major places, there's not enough room currently for the current demand for people who need to bike and walk, where you've got a lot of density in an area and you've got narrow sidewalks and everyone is suddenly at home all the time and they've got to walk their dogs. It's like, there's not enough room on, like, Monument Avenue, for example. I'm not saying that it's any more important than any others, but because it's a pretty well-known place, Monument Avenue is super wide, has a bunch of traffic lanes on it, and it's in the heart of a dense neighborhood, and it has pretty narrow sidewalks, at least in several sections where you've got a lot of tree planters and that kind of thing. The more space that you can build for people who bike and walk, the more we can spread out, which has been a bit of a challenge.
Mm-hmm. So there's going to be a lot of benefits to Virginians by building more of these trails, well beyond just having a place for people to recreate.
Absolutely.
This sounds like the perfect opportunity to ask how people can get involved in advocating for trails.
Well, I have to say that it all starts with you have the power to make a statement now. Like you don't need any special training, and you don't need to be any kind of a special person to send a really effective email or note to your city council person or your supervisor. Because you might be surprised at just how few emails they get from citizens about things like this. And you might not get a yes immediately. Transportation advocacy in particular is extremely slow. It takes a long time to build stuff. The funding cycles take a really long time. We got a bike lane built this year in Richmond that the process started for that in 2014. It's better late than never. And that seems to be more and more the case, where it just takes a long time to secure the funding from major entities like the state or the feds, to do all the paperwork, to get it all approved, to get the contracts lined up. You have to learn to be responsive and to kind of front load your community development and community mindedness around the biking and walking infrastructure advocacy space. But that doesn't mean that you shouldn't start and start meeting people and start talking to people about it. And no matter what I would suggest is find the people who are already doing it in your community. There probably are already. And if there aren't, I would try to find someone around you in another community or at the state level to kind of give you some tips and tricks, because you really can't do it by yourself. And so don't start with a recipe that's not going to work for you, because it can be for the best, most organized, most successful organizations. It still feels like we're continually pulling our hair out, and we're always having to adjust and pivot. And it often can feel like we get 80% or 50% of what we wanted. And you just have to kind of learn that that's progress and it's the long haul. But that all starts with you introducing yourself or introducing this concept and this topic to the folks who have the power to give it to you, which is your local elected officials who have the ability to adjust local budgets, and they have the ability to adjust and work with and hire and fire staff who understand things like bike infrastructure funding and bike infrastructure design, and to kill them with kindness and persistence too. Like, just be nice and likable, and you're much more likely to get what you want. To kind of paint a picture of the positive vision that you need, and just keep at it. And always be growing the pie. Recruit friends and family, meet new people and neighbors to help uplift the mission. And along the way, learn as much as you can about what bike infrastructure looks like. Learn as much as you can about how your decision makers think and feel, what their voting is like. And at the end of the day, you have to get a win in the budget or you haven't won anything. Because if you don't have a dedicated budget for bike infrastructure, your locality can't spend any money on it. And so you won't be able to get grants that require matches from the state or the feds. I'm more than happy to give you some advice, and you can reach me by email. Or send us a note over at BikeWalkRVA on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, or our website. We'd love to help you.
Perfect. And we can include those links in the show notes to make it easier for people to connect with you and to connect with your organization if they're interested in becoming advocates for trails. So I want to wrap this conversation up. This has been really great, both hearing about your adventures biking across the U.S. and across Virginia, but also in hearing about the advocacy portion of the work that you do to make trails safe and to connect communities across Virginia. But I want to wrap up by asking you a couple of questions that I have been asking my other guests, starting with, what is one piece of gear you cannot live without?
I've learned a ton about bike gear, and I had to make a lot of really tough decisions about which things I was going to bring across the country, because you don't get to swap it out, once you kind of started. Once I started riding for a while, like I would say get a bike. I would say get a saddle that it's comfortable to sit on. If you want to go with some clipless shoes, people seem to like those a lot. One of the things that once you get that kind of basic bike setup established, The thing that made a really big difference for me is a dynamo powered light, which is essentially a hub powered light. So you don't have to have batteries. You don't have to take your light on and off of your bike. You get a hub, or you can also just buy the whole wheel for the front of your bike. And it has a little generator in the hub, and that just is wired up through your fork and up to your handlebars or somewhere near your handlebars. And you get a dedicated headlight for your bike that doesn't require, it's extremely low maintenance. You don't have to do anything for it. And it has a little switch. You can turn it on, you can turn it off. They are much brighter. They have a much, it's hard to describe, but they have like a really great light patch on the ground that doesn't look like a flashlight with a really bright circle, and it's everything else outside of that circle is dark. Instead, they have like a really useful headlight patch on the ground that is good for seeing a much bigger area and also makes things more noticeable, I guess, as it doesn't overpower any particular place. And you don't have to worry about the lights going out. Like, I could not have crossed the country if I had only battery operated or charging lights, because I wouldn't have been able to charge them fast enough. And I wouldn't have been able to buy enough batteries to make them reliable when I'm riding after dark 6 hours a day. But even like on my commuter bike now, which is where I've got one, I don't ever have to think about having a bike light. I ride at night a fair amount, and I recommend doing it because it's a lot of fun. But having a good light is going to be super necessary. And knowing that you have one that's reliable and don't ever have to think about, it's just a big game changer. And you can get some that record or that have a USB charging port, so that you can always charge your phone. You're not stuck with a dead phone and lost somewhere.
I think that's something I need to get.
Yeah, it's a game changer.
You know, right now I just have the little battery powered things, which works for me because I haven't done, you know, overnight pack riding yet. But I think it's something I'm going to need to get because it's something I want to get into. So as you are riding all of these trails, I'm sure you're coming across a lot of local businesses, especially as you're passing through some of Virginia's small towns. Do you have any local businesses that you would recommend for, and it could be, you know, for food, it could be for gear, it could be something completely different, but places that people definitely need to stop and check out along the way?
Gosh, there are a ton. One of my favorite things, one of the things that I do at Sportsbackers is I manage our Bike Month program, which at one time was the unofficially largest Bike Month program in the country, which I feel a lot of pride about. And our relatively small metro area and around Richmond was able to produce such a big community support for something like that. And one year, our theme was Bikes Mean Business. And it was our goal that year to connect bike riders to local businesses, everything from coffee shops and bars to local tourism destinations and museums and clothing stores. And, you know, we really like supporting local businesses in Richmond, and bikes are just the best way to get places. And, you know, we have a little bit of an agenda where we want to see like more bike parking built. We want to see more bike lanes connecting to business corridors. And one of the great things about the Ashland to Petersburg Trail is it will connect a number of business corridors in Ashland and in Lakeside and in Henrico and along the Route 1 corridor and down into Petersburg, Old Town Petersburg in particular. It's going to be wonderful to be able to bike down to Petersburg to go to like Trapezium Brewery or to a lot of the, as I mentioned, the taco shops in Chesterfield or one of the big store stops that people love to go to on the regular kind of recreational rides in our region is the Ashland Ashland Coffee and Tea coffee shop. It's like you go there on a Saturday morning and you can see 50 people hanging out there in the middle of their ride. And I really have to give a big shout out to, I love every local bike shop in Richmond. I don't have any favoritism. You can get really great service and bikes at all of them. And I've spent money in just about every single one of them. But I have to give a little bit of a special shout out to Outpost because they helped me prepare for my ride. And they specialize in these kind of long distance bikes. They really know, they've really helped build the culture around these randonneuring and what we like to call big dumb rides as far as we can possibly go sometimes overnight. And so they can really help you figure out what you need for your bike to make it more comfortable or to go farther, to be more efficient. They have a couple of local bike brands. My bike was an Endpoint that's really purpose-made for this kind of thing. But another thing that really helps them stand out is they are a bodega as well. Like one of the cool things about some of the best bike shops that I've been to have is like a beer tap and a bar that you can hang out at. They take this one step farther and they have local produce, they have snacks and bread, and they kind of have that like extra 20% of groceries that you might need to like make a meal. You've got all your staples, but you just need like a little, you need a lime and some cilantro and like a nice six pack. That's why they've got that stuff for you. And it really has been a game changer in the Forest Hill, Westover Hills community where they're located, to be able to like not just get your bike serviced, but it gives you a reason to go to the bike shop for other than like when you don't just need a tube. Like you just go hang out at the bike shop because you need some celery and local eggs thing that I think all bike shops should be thinking about.
Let's close this out by asking what your next big Virginia outdoor adventure is going to be.
I feel a little bit of a pressure, but I will like, do I have to have another one? Like at some point you can tap out, right? But I will say, as much as I've loved biking, I have decided to take a little bit of a break. I still ride, and especially when my girlfriend makes me ride. But I have made a little bit of a transition into running, in part because I'm surrounded by a company full of runners. I've fallen into love with running a little bit, especially trail running. My next big adventure, I think, is to run the Ashland to Petersburg Trail in one go. So it's 42, 43 miles. It's a proper ultra. Before too much of it is built. Like I wanted to be this kind of adventure, rugged, kind of trailblazing, bushwhacking adventure with just enough permissions that I don't get arrested.
All right. Well, that sounds like an adventure in and of itself, and I can't wait to hear how that goes. Brantley, thank you so much for being a guest on Virginia Outdoor Adventures. It's been a pleasure.
It was so fun. Thanks for having me.
Thanks for joining us for this week's episode. Be sure to subscribe to Virginia Outdoor Adventures on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, and wherever you may listen to podcasts. If you enjoy the show, please rate, review, or share with a friend, and follow us on our Facebook and Twitter pages. Until next week, adventure on.